Today our show is about emerging new technologies, synthetic biology, and gene drives. Should we be concerned? Our guest today on the phone in San Rafael is journalist and author Claire Hope Cummings. Claire is author of Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering, and the Future of Seeds. She was an environmental lawyer for 20 years, four of them with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. As an environmental lawyer, she saw how government regulations were being dismantled during the Reagan administration and watched the rise of toxic industries, including genetic engineering in agriculture. She was shocked and concerned about the public health impacts and the right to know and the right to have a say about what's in our food. Her work as a public radio and television reporter and as a writer addresses those issues. Claire Hope Cummings, welcome to Post Carbon Radio.
Oh, thanks so much, Bing. It's great to be with you.
Great. Hi, Claire. And our other guest on the phone in Montreal, Canada, is Jim Thomas. Jim is a research program manager and writer at Etc. Group, or ETC Group, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the conservation and sustainable advancement of cultural and ecological diversity and human rights. To this end, ETC Group supports socially responsible developments of new technologies, and they address international governance issues and corporate power. Jim's background is in communications, writing on emerging technologies and international campaigning. For the 7 years previous to joining ETC Group, Jim was a researcher and campaigner on genetic engineering and food issues for Greenpeace International, working in Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, and Southeast Asia. He has extensive experience on issues around transgenic crops and nanotechnologies. He has written articles, chapters, and technical reports in the media and online. Trained as an historian to look back at the history of technology, Jim is now busy communicating the future of technology. Jim Thomas, welcome to Post Carbon Radio.
Thanks, Karen.
Claire, would you like to start and give us an overview of our topic today?
Well, okay. I'll take an effort at that. It's such an important emerging issue, and I think there's a couple things that we really want to make sure people understand. And one is that unlike the genetically modified organisms a lot of people in the community have been concerned about, these new technologies are not quite right, you know, ready to be deployed. And this is both a problem and an opportunity. Let me just mention the problem, which is that they're extremely powerful, and I hope Jim will get more into how they work and how they're created and, you know, what some of the threats are. But the opportunity that I think is important to emphasize here is that we can get out ahead of these. You know, when GMOs were released, they were done without our knowledge, without, as you mentioned in the intro, without public input as to how they'd be regulated or whether or not we really wanted them in our food. So now we might have a say, and this creates, I think, a burden for us. But in these times, in this post-election time, we have a natural opportunity to get together and make our voice heard in ways that we never did before. So we're talking about newly emerging technologies that people might not be familiar with. And if you don't mind, I'd like to hand this over to Jim to kind of outline what those technologies are and what we should be concerned about.
Sure. And we're fine to go with Jim. And we have some really basic questions to start, just to, as you're saying, to introduce the terminology, because people are familiar with GMOs, but they may not be familiar with what exactly synthetic biology is. Jim, do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure, absolutely. And you know, it's not a bad place to start to talk, but start by talking about GMOs that people are used to in their food and somewhat growing in the fields. That we've had now around 40 years, actually, of that kind of genetic engineering, what's sometimes called recombinant DNA. And that kind of genetic engineering, this sort of first generation, let's call it GMOs 1.0, is about going into the living codes at the heart of the living things, the DNA, and trying to cut out little genetic sequences, sometimes they get called genes, and move them across to other organisms with a sort of cut-and-paste approach. And that's been a You know, that's had big implications. It's had big implications in agriculture already, but it's a kind of an experimental approach. There's only so far you can go with it. And now what we're at really is, as genetic engineering hits middle age, 40 years or so, and we've had it in our foods and so forth for 20 years, we've now got a real switch in the underlying technology of how companies and scientists are manipulating life. So what's at play here is that whereas previously you had to go out and find the bit of genetic code you wanted to cut out from an organism and insert into another organism, that was a sort of slow process in the lab, now you can change the genetic code in an organism much, much more swiftly. You can either print out the DNA you want on what's basically a DNA printer. It's called a DNA synthesizer. So you can get any genetic code you want and just print it out. In fact, you can just order it on the internet and have it sent to you. Or you can use and that's called DNA synthesis. Or you can use a series of techniques, they're called gene editing, where you can go in and just re-edit the codes, the DNA codes, as if you were re-editing a sentence on a word processor. Of course, it's not that. Life isn't actually a sentence on a word processor, and these things aren't sort of machines. But increasingly, you have an industry that's treating life in that way, as if you could just reprogram life forms, reprogram the codes as if this was a computing approach.
And Jim, do you want to jump into CRISPR as one of those editing techniques?
Yeah, for certain. I mean, that's one that people will have heard of. so these editing techniques, that they have names like zinc fingers and talons, but CRISPR is the one that's causing a lot of excitement, and certainly there's a lot of money flowing into this particular technique. What it does is it allows a genetic engineer to sort of do a sort of search and replace function, almost. They can send a little piece of RNA. That's a sort of a short protein, if you like, that can go along the DNA, find a particular place on the DNA code, cut it, and then put in another piece of DNA. So it's like a kind of search and replace function or a cutting function. That's certainly how the synthetic biology companies, these new GMO 2.0 companies, present it, as if this was a sort of precise way of changing the DNA codes at the heart of living things. Of course, one of the things you learn as you look at this area of biotechnology, whether it's GMOs 1.0 or GMOs 2.0, is it's never as precise as they like to make out. You're talking about life here. It's a messy and complex thing, and then that's pretty poorly understood.
Well, where does this term gene drives fit in, and what are they, and how do they work, and what do they do?
the span of synthetic biology, this new area of engineering life in this way, spans all the way from trying to produce little organisms that will make flavors or fragrances or oils and so forth. That's most of what's going on in this industry. But there's now a very real interest in trying to release organisms into the wild that will change the wild, that will change ecosystems. And the idea here is that can we engineer an organism, let's say a mouse or a mosquito or a fruit fly, that once you've released it, it will copy its genetic change to every single one of its progeny. So if it's a fruit fly, all of its offspring will have this genetic change, and all of its offspring will have this change until the entire population of fruit flies are carrying whatever that change is. And this is the idea of a gene drive, the idea that you can drive a genetic trait, a new engineered trait, through an entire population or an entire species.
And remind us how that's different from normal inheritance.
Sorry?
Remind us how that's different from normal Mendelian inheritance.
Sure. So, I mean, usually if you, for example, if I genetically engineer an organism and release it into the environment and it mates with another related organism, we could expect about 50% of its offspring would carry a trait. So say you engineer it to glow green, maybe about 50% would glow green, and 50% of those and 50% of those. Over time, it will get lost in the general population. The difference here is you're overturning that. 100% of its offspring would glow green, and 100% of that offspring would glow green. And so through that process, you would take over an entire population.
So as you said, the notion of drive is that you're driving it into the population.
That's right. You're driving into the population. You're altering entire populations. What this means is that genetic engineers can be thinking not just in engineering a single organism or a few organisms that they release, but looking to engineer an entire species just by the release of a single organism.
Claire, what are your concerns about the ecological repercussions of these new emerging technologies?
Right. It's always good to listen to the clear way that Jim explains this, but I'd like to add more of an emotional tone, which is that these are unprecedented and powerful. And the best way to think about what we're faced with right now is that we're making two incorrect assumptions. One is that human beings have the right to release a synthetic organism that could possibly change an entire species or an entire ecological system, that we might have the right to do that. I mean, that's a troubling question, but the more, to me, right now, in terms of ecological issues, the most troubling questions is the assumption that we know how these will work, that we know how removing one species will impact another species. For instance, if you did kill off all the mosquitoes, you know, how would that affect the larger ecological system and the interdependency of life forms there? So I like to think of it in terms of that we are not asking the right questions. We don't know so much, and that's the question that you and I have talked about being about hubris and how that's functioning here. And along those lines, you know, Jim was talking about the manipulation in the biological sense or in the genetic sense, but I think it's really also important in my work. I've covered genetic engineering for the last 40 years, mostly 20 years, but we've been concerned about it for that long of a time. But this is also a social intervention and a social manipulation. I think what's going on here is that it's about control, and it kind of comes across as control of the natural world or you know, the GMO industry would say we're controlling weeds or we're controlling insects, you know, in order to have better, you know, production and food. Of course, that's not true, but that's the way they sell it. What's behind that is the control over the natural world, a social intervention, actually, where we say technology is the way we live, the way we interact with the natural world. And that has creeped into our lives and into our thinking in a way that really is troubling to me, because we've never taken time out to say, do we really want this? And then ask those other two questions about, you know, do we have the right to do some of these things, which is an ethical question, and do we have the knowledge, which is a sort of ecological literacy question. You know, do we really know what we're doing, right?
That's a great frame, Claire, and I want to get back to it. I just want to ask one thing back to Jim. Before we move on, because I'm trying to anticipate some listener skeptical questions. I mean, gene drives, the sort of the technology, if you will, the capacity to drive a gene into a population does occur in nature somewhat, right? How is this different from the sort of ability to do that in nature?
Well, those who are moving forward this technology claim, and it may be true, that there are natural genetic elements that will sort of more likely get passed on. But these are sort of natural gene drives. And that what they're doing is, rather than just going with the natural gene drives, you know, the elements that will more likely get passed on, we're choosing which elements we want to pass on. And so, you know, first of all, that's different. This is about the genetic engineer deciding to play evolution, not just over a single organism, but over an entire population, an entire species, and by extension, an entire ecosystem. In effect, you're short-circuiting some of the mechanisms of Darwinian selection and so forth that would determine which traits persist and survive in the environment, and giving them an unnatural advantage. And so that's, you know, that's upsetting an ecological balance. It may also be playing with a sort of a genetic balance. The decisions on which genetic traits get passed on from generation to generation are poorly understood, and you're really sort of just forcing through that which trait is going to move forward.
Thank you. And with that, Claire, do you want to resume on this sort of engineering mindset or playing genetic god, or I'm not sure what metaphor you would use to describe the ethical dimensions that you were raising?
Well, I think we'd like to think that we live in a democracy. I'm not sure we feel that way a lot right now. But if, in fact, we assume we have some choice in our lives, and we also assume that we have some moral standing as a species, then I think this idea of participation and education, I was just reading, for instance, this idea of releasing genetically modified mosquitoes. These are not gene-drive mosquitoes, but they're being proposed to be released in Florida. So they had a vote during this election, and there was a vote in two parts of Monroe County, Florida. And now the press is saying, I'll tell you what the results are in a second, but now the press is saying that Monroe County, Florida approved in a referendum on Election Day the release of Florida, of GMO mosquitoes in Florida. This is to address the Zika virus. Well, that's not actually accurate or true, right? And so the way the media tells us what's going on here has already been manipulated. So I see the manipulation happening in many layers. It might start in the laboratory with the manipulation of an organism, but the people who want to sell this for either reasons of profit or natural control or social control, they're manipulating what's said about it. They're manipulating what we know about it, right? So I think that we really have our work cut out for us here in pulling back from this sort of tidal wave of false news, bad news. It's being, the way the peril is being presented to us. I have a whole collection of articles about this virus or that fungus or this crop is going to, has rust and all these perils. They're all say, here's this terrible thing that's happening. And, at the end they say, and here's our great technological fix. So they pair up. Sorry, go ahead, Jim.
Go ahead.
Well, Claire, remind us what the actual election results were.
I'm sorry. Yeah, right. So the actual results were that one community, Key Haven, Florida, where they had been told they were actually going to release the GMO mosquitoes, they voted overwhelmingly to not have that happen. They voted against it. And another community that was just given a little bit of information and who was told they would not be subject to this release voted somewhat in approval for it. But by setting that up with one community that would actually have the problem and one community that's more theoretical, they were able to manipulate the result and get one community to say, well, maybe, 50-60% of the people think that might be a good idea. But they were not being told that it would be them. So then the people who put these two referendums together in these communities were able to say that the outcome of the vote was to approve the experimental release of GMO mosquitoes.
Did they take an average of the two?
Pardon?
Did they take an average of the two results?
No. No. 57% of the vote in the other area approved this, I believe, and 65% of the Key Haven voters disapproved of the release of GMOs. So the people who were most affected by it, and that's important, right? What you're told, it affects very much how you respond to a situation like this. So so what was going on here, and this has not been reported in the media, was not so much that people were actually being asked, but that they were being part of a setup so that promoters of this particular GMO mosquito could say there was approval. And then down at the end of the article, and oh, by the way, this one community said no. So it's been completely dishonest manipulation of the information people are getting.
So what you're told is very important, especially when we get to talk about things like gene drives. If anybody does a Google search on gene drives, you'll very quickly learn that the prime reason they're being promoted, supposedly, is to battle malaria or Zika, the idea that we can eradicate all of the mosquitoes that might carry these diseases, maybe down the line, things like schistosomiasis and so forth. And that story, which is being, the funding is coming from the Gates Foundation and the Tata Foundation, is being very, very strongly pushed that this is what gene drives are for. But when you begin to look at what's actually happening in terms of the research and where the patents are and where this is likely to go, more likely, gene drives are going to be used in agriculture, and they're probably going to be used for military purposes. And yes, there'll be some possible use in dealing with vector-borne diseases, but that raises all sorts of tricky questions. And so we see, for example, proposals to release gene drives into farmers' fields to make weeds more susceptible to Roundup, to Monsanto's Roundup. And that means that, of course, Monsanto can keep selling their Roundup pesticide. You could imagine ways in which this can be used to suppress harvests. And interestingly enough, one of the largest funders here is the defense establishment. This is potentially a very potent bioweapon, and so forth. And when you begin drawing back the picture and seeing where this could go, then the idea that it might potentially be a silver bullet for dealing with malaria and Zika becomes less certain, and certainly has to be balanced against how this platform will be used.
Claire, can you
add to that? Yeah, hold on a second. Bing, I would just add to that that not only military, but the funding for research that goes into this is being manipulated as well. So we have a lot of universities who are signing up to develop mechanisms for these technologies, particularly gene drives. And one thing I learned from covering GMOs is that this is a violent technology. You know, it began with using a gene gun, right? It's like we literally took a modified 22 weapon and shot these genes into plants to see if they'd take it up. And it's been, you know, it's based in violence, and I could go on with that analogy on so many aspects of our lives. But I just noticed in looking at the agricultural uses that they're named things like Viper, you know, and Viper stands for viruses and insects as plant enhancement resources. So I just have this theme, and I hope we'll get to the issue of daughterlessness too, where even how we name these reveals to us our underlying, I think, irresistible impulse to try to control the natural world. And I'm hoping that's ringing bells with people and saying, whoa, you know, maybe we're on the wrong track.
I have a question based on what you just said, Claire. Would you, and Jim, I'd be interested in your thoughts as well, would either of you classify gene drive technology as dual use, that is, both defensive against pests and potentially offensive? I wasn't sure exactly what you were implying, Jim, about whether gene drives used to reduce agricultural yield could be used as a bioweapon to threaten a purported enemy's food supply.
I was meaning exactly that.
Okay.
And in fact, there's a number of ways in which gene drives could either supercharge existing bioweapons or be used as novel bioweapons in themselves. Because one of the problems of delivering a biological weapon is getting it out there enough. You know, nature kind of can overwhelm it. But here you have something that once you release just a single one, it will reproduce itself in a population and take over. And so you could imagine that military interests are extremely interested in that. So we've seen the U.S. Department Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, which does some of the kind of more outlandish and maybe scarier defense research, is going all in on gene drives. They have one project, they call it the Safe Genes Project, which is all about how they could interfere with gene drives gone wrong, with rogue gene drives. Of course, that assumes from the beginning that gene drives could be used for either bioterror or bioerror. And then they also have a second project, which they've just recently announced they want to fund, which looks at ways of harnessing insects to deliver genetic engineering on the field, to genetically engineer things in a sort of roving way. All of these are just some of the ways in which this could be weaponized.
Would that be like pixie dust that they would be spreading genetic alteration?
Well, yeah, I think what we're talking about here is organisms. So some of the scenarios that I've seen are, can you engineer a stinging, biting insect so that it could deliver a lethal toxin? And if you could do that, then you could have that spread using a gene drive.
So it would be a vector.
Yeah.
I actually literally burst into tears this morning when I was reading about a dragonfly that's being that could, you know, the proposal is to use a dragonfly to steer a dragonfly to deliver as a delivery system. It's called steering insect flight with optogenic neuromodulation. I love this language. It's unbelievable. I burst into tears. I love dragonflies. They're one of my favorite, you know, parts of this gorgeous planet we live on. And I hope people feel that when you hear about these things, that we realize the power and the unprecedented level of technological control that's being proposed here.
And now back to our show today, Emerging New Technologies, Synthetic Biology and Gene Drives, Should We Be Concerned? And our guests today are Claire Hope Cummings, who's author of Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Seeds, and Jim Thomas of the ETC Group. And now we would like to open up our phone lines to listeners. You can call in on 415-663-8317. That's 415-663-8317. And let's get back to Claire. I know your concerns about gene drives and their use in conservation. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. This is how I got into finding out about this difficulty we're facing here. There's a very cynical move to get gene drives to be accepted and kind of get in the back door for people's approval and also to avoid regulatory control, I think. We can talk about the regulatory framework separately, but basically, and Jim is the one who told me about this, there were some meetings that were held where people came up with clever ideas for how gene drives could be used in conservation. And I just want to emphasize that I, and I know most of the people I work with, really support science, especially independent, public-based science. And so innovation and science is not something we're talking about here. We're talking about a particular technology that has not been studied, that the research is inadequate on, that's very, very powerful, potentially very dangerous, and that that they would be released without those studies. So to have that happen in the natural world as if it's going to help the natural world, and the example would be, and Jim had mentioned this earlier, is on the island of Hawaii, there are birds that are suffering from avian malaria, and the vector for that is a mosquito. So the people who are proposing these gene drives are saying that they can release a gene drive mosquito, eradicate that particular mosquito. It's such a narrow way of it's almost like the old pesticide idea where you have one pest and you use one chemical and it's that impulse to control something very selectively like that without any regard for all the other ecological consequences of doing that. So, for instance, on the island of Kauai, there's also another endangered species, the hoary bat. And presumably that bat would eat mosquitoes too. So what would happen to the bat? Are we going to sacrifice the bats for the birds? And how are we going to make that decision? So that's just an example of how even in the conservation field, there's a lot of unanswered questions that really must be addressed before we seriously consider doing something like this.
And Claire, you referred to how we're going to make that decision, but who the we is who's going to make that decision is also important too. Tell us about the International Union for the Conservation of Nature confab that you just attended.
Right. Jim and I were there along with Dana Pearls at Friends of the Earth, who's doing really great work in educating people about synthetic biology. So I highly recommend people to go to Friends of the Earth website as well as ETC's. And we were all at the IUCN, which was in Honolulu this year. And Jim can tell you about the motion that was done around synthetic biology there. But one of the reasons I was there is I've worked in the islands for over 30 years, 40 years, and I care very much about community there and the right of the indigenous people to have a say in what happens in their communities. So we, in addition to being at the large international meeting, we put on a workshop and a panel saying, you know, who decides for Hawaii? And there's a movement in Hawaii going on right now that's coming up, grassroots, community-based, that are saying we want to have control over technologies, our food supply, water, all these other issues. It's a sacred site. This is a very strong movement now, and it's indigenous-led, a lot of echoes with what's happening at Standing Rock. And I'm really excited about this because I'm hoping that these communities can start taking control over the government's functions. Now, there's been, they did pass some moratoriums even on GMOs and labeling. The industry, Syngenta and Monsanto and Dow came in and recently won a lawsuit stopping that community effort. But that's just enlivening the communities there. They're going to be taking action back in their own hands. Everything from growing their own food and setting up biological barriers for these things to really being able to educate the government officials that are kind of prone to thinking technological solutions might be exciting and interesting. They have to be educated. The press has to be educated so that people know what's really going on. And all of these are coming up there. It's going to be a great experiment to see whether or not we can be successful against this.
We have a caller. Hold on. Yes, Eleanor, you're on the line.
Hi.
You have a question.
Yes. It's a very interesting program. Thanks very much. A few things come to my mind. First of all, isn't a threat of an enemy food supply a violation of international war law or a war crime? That's one thing. And then also, kind of a more general question, this language that these people are employing, gene drives, and I think of Roundup Ready, something, you know, ready, that's such a positive word, gene drives, that's so neutral, and Safe Genes Project, isn't that nice? And how can people who oppose these technologies change the language so that there's more of an understanding of what a threat to nature these technologies pose?
I can speak to the first one, and I'm sure Claire would have much to say about the second. You're exactly right that the prospect for gene drive to have implications for global law around war and military use are quite high. In fact, certainly if the U.S. were to say that they were developing gene drives as bioweapons, they would immediately become in violation of the International Bioweapons Convention. So, of course, they're not going to say that. But in fact, even there is an international convention, which was the last environmental convention that the treaty that the U.S. signed. It's called the ENMOD Treaty, the Environmental Modification Treaty, and it was agreed in 1977. And it prohibits the hostile use of environmental modification, including modifying, like this, species and ecosystems for the hostile uses. So gene drives could very well be tripping up the Environmental Modification Treaty because they're very much a dual-use technology. And, of course, if they were ever applied to bioweapons and to suppressing harvests and so forth, then it would have other impacts in international law.
Thank you for the call, Eleanor.
The language.
Claire, did you want to weigh in on that?
Thanks, Karen. You know, I think it's the whole thing. I think language is everything. If I've learned anything from Indigenous people, it's the power of the word, how we name things, how, you know, it does form what we think and who we are. So this is all about redefining what it means to be human, isn't it? Because we either are part of an interdependent life, you know, one large organism, or we are in control. And so as we move towards one or the other, we need to think about the words we use and the names we give things. I just feel so, and I know other people do, especially out in West Marin, feel so strongly that we've been, that there's been a lot of bamboozling going on. And so I think maybe our first line of defense would be to consider, to get together and to talk about this issue of our language and our words and authenticity and what is real, and start trying to address it in little pieces. I think there's 100 pieces where we can go with this, but naming things correctly for what they are. Jim, I'm wondering if you would name, can you come up with an appropriate name? Like Eleanor said, gene drives are kind of neutral. What would be a way to name what's really going on here?
Well, we've been talking about them a little bit in a couple of different ways. One is we say that they're sort of enforcer genes. They enforce an outcome and push an outcome, and there is that sort of authoritarian aspect to them. The other is that in some ways these are gene bombs. You know, you drop one of these things into an ecosystem, and it spreads out and changes everything. And certainly, you know, the military interest in it is that way. So, you know, there are other ways of thinking about this, for sure. I think what's often revealing, though, is some of the ways in which the gene drive developers describe their work unconsciously reveals some of their own biases and assumptions. You were talking about the daughterless mouse project. I don't know if you wanted to mention something about that, Claire. That's certainly a horrifying prospect, and it has all sorts of implications.
Right, and I think they're stopping using the term daughterless, which I don't want to let them do, but it is the eradication of the female in order to make a good. This is an unprecedented assault. It's a planned assault on the natural world and perhaps the female, if this is emblematic of the thinking behind the creation of these new technologies, is that they can do anything they want. And every woman I've described this to, basically a daughterless organism is an organism that's been genetically manipulated so that it can't give, there are no female offspring ever again. You know, once they give birth, that's their last bit. So immediately, whatever the organism is, a sexually reproducing organism at least, would be wiped out because there's no female.
I have a question about
the
that.
Yeah, I just want to say every woman I've talked to about this is horrified. What, Karen?
Oh, just wanted to understand the mechanism. Is it just that it drives the Y chromosome from the male?
Jim?
No, it interrupts the female fertility or something. It depends on what you're using it in, but it basically interrupts the formation of female chromosome, I think, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. I did some research on where this started, and I think it's a term that comes up even in Game of Thrones, and it came up. The first use I saw was in 1988, and then more recently, about 10, 15 years ago, with the development of what they call the daughterless carp. But an organization, this is a conservation organization that raises money to protect birds, called Island Conservation out of Santa Cruz. They are promoting the use of a gene drive mouse for islands, and this is the daughterless mouse they want to use. And I just want to say, you know, how can a conservation organism take that kind of unprecedented control over reproduction in the natural world? It's unbelievable. But they have no qualms about saying that this is going to be an effective way to save bird species on islands. One of the things we haven't mentioned about a lot of these things is that they're not precise and that accurate. In fact, let me give you two things to think about from just one release of GMO mosquitoes in mosquito. They said that, you know, that one of it is that all male mosquitoes are being released because male mosquitoes don't bite. And there's the interbreeding there would presumably interrupt. These are GMO, not gene drive. But then they, you know, in parenthesis in the Guardian article, it says, well, one out of every 1,000 could be female. So they're kind of hinting that the precision that's assumed in these technologies really isn't present. And contamination really is an issue with farm salmon. All of our experience with GMOs says, you know, if it's alive, it's going to get out. It's going to want to breed. It's going to want to live. And, you know, we should respect that.
And it's going to mutate. I mean, the thing is you're betting here against evolution, and evolution always wins. So to release something with an expectation that it's going to be a predictable mechanism that's going to keep moving on like a machine until it exterminates everything is to not reckon with nature's ability to out-innovate. But in the process of doing so, you know, as nature develops resistance against these gene drives, we're going to see all sorts of ecological perturbation.
I'd like to jump. Okay, go ahead, Bring. I wanted to just jump in and talk about regulations and how that's not working, but you can go first.
Well, I just wanted to ask, there's an initiative called Safe Genes, and it seems to be Kevin Esvelt, head of the Sculpting Evolution Lab at MIT Media Lab, who is applying for safety funding with collaboration with 8 other research groups. They predict that eventually an accident will allow a drive with potential to spread globally to escape laboratory controls. What are your thoughts about that Safe Dreams initiative?
Yeah, so this actually is the project that's being funded by the U.S. military, the Safe Dreams Project, by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And, you know, it takes as its initial starting point that there will be gene drives gone bad and gene drives gone wrong. And I think that's right. Kevin Esfeldt, who's mentioned in the article that you're referring to, who's applying for that, is the person who owns the patent, or whose name is on the patent on gene drives. He's a big promoter of gene drives, and he's also been very, very clear in admitting that, yes, these will go global, these will potentially eradicate entire species, and that the impacts are wide and deep and highly problematic. I think most who work in this area kind of recognize that, and they don't quite know how to deal with that, but they're at the same time thrilled by the possibility.
Mm. Claire, do you want to talk about the regulatory...
Well, let me just say about Kevin, I think he's a really interesting, very bright person, but I think we're looking at this irresistible need to deal with these powerful forces. I don't think that part of the human psyche has actually been really well explored or named or talked about, you know, what's really going on behind that. I got the impression in a long hour-and-a-half interview I did with Kevin Esfeldt during IUCN, that he actually thinks it would be interesting. Now, I'm not putting that on him. I'm just saying that was my impression, which is that some people are not as concerned about the natural world. This is a serious problem because people, as we lost more and more, you know, connection with the natural world, we don't really have an instinct that this is a serious, threatening problem, right? So, you know, well, I don't know what could happen. You know, it's a very sort of vagueness. And whereas those of us who are constantly involved and dependent on the natural world are pretty clear that, you know, this is a disaster waiting to happen. So is there any way for government agencies or communities to intervene? The short answer is there are no effective tools presently. There are some weak regulations that apply to GMOs, especially, you know, the experimental ones. But I think there's two things people need to understand. One is that there's no good independent science which is informing the regulatory system, so that the regulations we have are cobbled together from actually chemical issues. And I hope Jim will talk about what's going to happen in Mexico soon at the COP, because this is an organization that deals with the precautionary principle. But our, in the United States, regulatory system is still tied in with risk-benefit, kind of based on, you know, how many millions of, you know, people will be affected and how many cancer deaths. So it's this terrible way of looking at risk and weighing, you know, the benefits or, you know, how many people will die. And instead of taking this precautionary, way of saying let's prevent all that harm and study it beforehand. But enforcement is an issue here, because even if you had regulations, if you're going to defund government agencies and you're going to have no political will to enforce them, then you can design around all these things, but it's still not going to happen. So all three parts have to happen. We have to have effective government agencies that have the will and the funding and the research in order to carry out some kind of a governance of how things are going to go as they go forward. Right now, everything is all voluntary.
So if you
I just want to add in something I was going to say earlier, which is that the name of the organization that's promoting the GMO releases in Florida is called the Florida Keys Safety Alliance. So again, you know, we don't even know if somebody says they're for safety, if they actually are really for safety, right? Or are they promoting something that's dangerous?
If you're just joining us, that is the voice of Claire Hope Cummings. She is the author of Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Seeds. And we're also joined by Jim Thomas, who's program director at the ETC Group. I'm your co-host, Cara Nyhus, with Bing Gong on Post Carbon Radio. And today we're talking about synthetic biology and, in particular, gene drives. Bing, did you have a question you wanted to take next?
Well, I have something on synthetic biology I'd like to ask Jim. You're concerned with about small farmers and third world farming communities and other groups who are not able to say no to the use of genetic technologies in many of their medicines and food sources could be altered forever, right? You know, tell us a little bit about vanilla that can be created synthetically.
Sure. There's something I'd mentioned earlier, that actually this new synthetic biology industry, which is growing very fast. There are billions of dollars going into companies who are already putting things on the market produced through synthetic biology, is at the moment really focused on producing food ingredients, flavor ingredients, fragrance ingredients. What they're doing is they're engineering yeast and algae to pump out things that are similar to vanilla flavor or to patchouli flavor or to orange flavor and so forth. And astonishingly, because of the way the laws are set up, they appear to be able to call those natural flavors because, in fact, these are sort of fermentation process. You do this in large vats full of sugar or methane. And so what you now have is some of the world's largest flavor and fragrance companies, some of the world's largest food companies, bringing forward vanilla flavor, for example, which they'll say is natural flavor, that has never been near a vanilla bean or a vanilla plant, and much less a vanilla farmer. And that's an immediate and present threat for vanilla farmers in Madagascar, in Mexico, in Comoros, in Reunion, in Uganda, and so forth. And at the same time, the forests where they grow natural vanilla, you're undermining those truly sustainable livelihoods which are supporting biodiversity. And it's happening not just to vanilla, it's happening across every single valuable plant compound that small farmers have been growing and sustaining throughout the tropics. That's an immediate and present threat from synthetic biology right now. And that's actually one of the things that will be hopefully dealt with at some level next week in Mexico when the Convention on Biological Diversity meets and discusses synthetic biology and tries to put in place governance over this burgeoning industry.
Thanks, Tim. Claire, I wanted to ask you, would you like to say a few words about biocolonialism?
Do we have another hour? Well, I think actually Jim is also mentioning that a bit as well. I mean, what happens to people who, the indigenous people and small farmers and traditional land-based people who care for the world's biodiversity, that's theirs. You know, this is respecting them, allowing them to have, as you mentioned, Bing, the right to say no. That's huge. And so this impulse that we have to control things is part of the colonial impulse, part of the colonial mindset. So we have this massive industry, and it's all based on biocolonialism. Frankly, regardless of who the thousands of years of caretaking might have produced, you know, the cultural relationship with these plants and organisms, frankly, it's a commons, right? It's everyone's. It's the right to life and to patent it and to try to own it and to synthesize it. This is something that's been going on now for quite a little while. And it has its roots in colonialism, which, you know, I mean, you think about it, it really has always been justified in terms of science and exploration. And I don't know whether it's a guise, but it might be sincere on many levels, but it goes badly very quickly when governments want to get something out of it, and then we have all those other issues involved. So we're using that same impulse to explore, but then to go into every aspect of the natural world, draw out the things that seem useful at the present time, and put them in a different framework, which is you know, a laboratory or, like, as Jim described, leaving indigenous people and the original caretakers, the people who live and depend on these natural forms to, you know, we leave them without what they depend on. So we haven't really worked out how to intercept that, because a lot of governments say they have control over their indigenous populations. So we have nation states who assumed control, again, at Standing Rock, at Mount Shasta in Northern California. We have emerging, and in Mount Akea in Hawaii, we have an emerging sense of sovereignty and control of the land and natural resources, as well as the sacred, going on. And I think that's where the environmental movement needs to go, is to supporting that, this emerging sense of what's right and what's real and what's going on the ground. And I hope we all can figure out how we're going to work in what we care about into supporting those communities.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Claire, because it seems like we're approaching the top of the hour. And so what we'd like to do is just round up for any final comments and let our listeners know how they can follow you, your work, and this issue, and get involved if they feel so inclined.
And how to support groups that are working advising people on the dangers of this new technology.
Well, I'll just sum up by saying I sent a check to ETC Group, the Friends of ETC Group, which is the U.S. group, because right now sending Jim and Dana Pearls from Friends of the Earth to Mexico to really ardently advocate on behalf of us has to happen. It's a practical thing to do. I'm very big on direct work that we need to do on the ground, and I do that. My website is clairehopecummings.com. Please feel free to get a hold of me through there. But I think right now there's an urgency to support organizations that are already set up and working on those issues.
Jim, why don't you tell us what you're going to be doing in Mexico?
Sure. Thanks very much, Claire, for mentioning that. So next week and the week after is going to be the meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity. It's 196 countries now around the world. The U.S. is almost the only one not there, but they're there in force, of course. And that's where there's going to be a major fight about the future of synthetic biology, and there are probably going to be countries who are going to be pushing for a moratorium on gene drives. So that's a moment where the international community is going to hopefully determine whether we can bring forward precaution and slow down and where necessary, stop some of the crazier directions, or whether it's full steam ahead with these dangerous technologies.
And how do people follow ETC Group?
Happening. So certainly it will be there, and as will many other groups from around the world. Our website is etcgroup.org, but I would encourage you to also go look at the synbiowatch.org website. That's where many organizations that track these issues, these new technologies, are putting up their information, their analysis, news about how they're trying to address the issues that are now arising.
Okay, well, thank you so much for those final comments. Unfortunately, we are at the top of the hour, and we have to go.
And we have one announcement. There's a beautiful full-length film on seeds. It's called Seeds, The Untold Story. It's Saturday, December 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Lark Theater in Larkspur. That's Saturday, December 3rd at 7 p.m. And Claire Hope Cummings, who's in the film, will do a Q&A after the film showing. Thank you so much, Claire and Jim, for joining us on Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you.